Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, Part 1. The first talk in a series titled Ethics of Sex in the Bible was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 30, 2014 at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in breaks in the recording. It is hoped that the notes will be sufficient to understand the teaching. Handout number 1, Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, accompanies this talk.
Okay, this class, if you want to call it that, is going to be pretty simple. I have fairly detailed notes. I want to read through the notes and then just talk about it. But what I want to do is have a controlled conversation, but you'll do the conversing. And this interaction at any point is absolutely fine with me. It may come to a point where I know that something is coming up in the notes, and I'll ask you if you might wait, but that would be the only sort of control I want to put on it, is just to ask you to wait until we get to that part in the notes. So feel free to contribute. They can go to the Gutenberg College website, is that correct?
Go to
the blog.
There's a blog that gives you instructions on how to get to the streaming.
Okay, so the Gutenberg blog on the Gutenberg College website will have instructions about how to get the notes that the rest of you, I hope, have now. Our conversation is going to be based on. Before we taught a number of times over many, many years, classes on love, marriage, sexuality, and so on, this is not that. This is not that class. I called it the ethics of sex in the Bible and concentrating on sexual ethics because I really am going to focus on why does the Bible take the perspective that it does on what it considers unrighteous or immoral or sinful? Why does it take that perspective? That's what I want to explore. I'm not going to get into dating and how you choose a marriage partner and stuff like that I might have done in past courses. That's not the focus of this class. What has prompted this is my sense in recent years that our culture is as confused about sexuality as it has ever been. We're very lost as a culture. We're not thinking straight about any ethical issue for that matter, but especially about sexual ethics and our sexuality. My desire is to sort of... Okay, so in the first part here, I want to consider biblical sexual ethics in the context of modern culture. So right from the get-go, I want to contrast. What does the Bible teach? What perspective does it take about sexuality? And how does that contrast with what our modern culture would tell us? So my first point is, from the perspective of modern culture, biblical sexual ethics will inevitably seem bizarre, out of touch, and uncool. And I think the main reason for making that point is to make it clear that I know that's the case. I mean, you're really uncool if you're uncool and you don't think you're uncool, right? But I know that I'm uncool. I know that my perspective is old-fashioned and bizarre and seems like I live on another planet. I know that, but my sexual ethics is grounded, I think, in what the Bible teaches and a biblical worldview, which overlaps a lot with what even the pagans throughout most of the centuries have also believed. I mean, it's not unique to the Bible, not unique to Christianity. Some aspects of it are. But it comes from a very, very different time in history than where we live. My contention is biblical ethics is evolutionary. And the point I want to make about that is that's a good thing. That's as it should be. That should be interesting to us. That should be attractive to us. Because from a biblical perspective, to be a follower of Jesus is to be a revolutionary. It's to be radical. And I think one of the things that's finally dawned on me is the difference between me and my generation and the younger generations coming I don't think the younger people today think of being radical and revolutionary as a good thing. I think they don't see it in those terms. That was just commonplace that you could be called, is to be called a revolutionary. And that is so easy that you could have any other. So when it comes to sexual ethics, as anything else with the Christian faith, I think it's important that we face the question, is it good or is it bad to be a revolutionary? And I think the right answer biblically is, it's good to be a revolutionary. We have been plopped down in darkness. We are surrounded by evil. We are surrounded by depravity. We are surrounded by a world culture that is trying to its mold. And the most significant thing we can do as a disciple of Jesus is to refuse to be shaped into its mold, and instead to take our cues from the Bible, as radical and revolutionary as those views are, and embrace the life of obedience to those very radical and revolutionary ideas. Does that put us out of step with modern culture? Absolutely. Is it because we're old-fashioned, or is it because we are radicals and revolutionary? I mean, those have a different connotation, I think, a different flavor. And I would argue it's because we're radical and revolutionary, not because we're old-fashioned and uncool. Now, what's going to be the beef that modern culture has with people like me or anybody who takes a burden? We'll typically view biblical sexual ethics as an unhealthy repression of our sexuality. From Freud on, this has been always the charge, is that you're just afraid of your sexuality. You just can't deal with it. You can't accept the fact that you are asexual. All of your ethics is intended to somehow protect you from the power and dynamic of your sexuality, rather than just embracing it and accepting it and being okay with it. So it's that repression of sexuality that is what's motivating your ethic. So the modern mindset, if one has old-fashioned values and beliefs about sexuality, ideas that are out of sync with the modern culturally accepted values and beliefs about sexuality, then the reason that you have those old-fashioned values is because your values and beliefs are purely and simply a product of a culture that was overly narrow, overly restrictive, uninformed, irrationally prejudiced against newer and hipper values and beliefs. And in fact, the newer and hipper values are truer. They are a truer basis for sexual ethics. And what does it boil down to, that truer basis? Being okay with being a sexual being. That's the important thing. Okay, now let me talk about that for a second. It's just as possible, however, that, and in fact I would argue more possible, that the newer values are the outcome of propaganda, of prejudice, and acculturation, as it is that the older values are purely and simply the outcome of prejudice and acculturation. I mean, that cuts both ways. Yes, if our ideas are different, it's likely that one of us has been acculturated to a different point of view, and we don't really know what we're talking about. We're not really in the right for dealing with our sexuality. That's true of one of us, but which is it? Is it the modern mindset or is it the biblical mindset? Which is more grounded in the reality of what it means to be a sexual being as a human being? What's really better grounded? I'm going to argue that the Bible is better grounded than the modern mindset. So, but both are going to look at the other and say, you're really lost here. And certainly the following principle is simply completely invalid. The set of values and beliefs that is newer and more recent is always more enlightened than the set of values and beliefs that is older and less recent. That's the essential principle of every form of progressivism, that kind of idea that going into the future is to make progress. It's to come up with better ideas and in a better way of thinking about it. I reject that out of hand. I don't think that's true, especially when it comes to sexuality. We are as lost as any culture has ever been in modern America. The other aspect of the modern mindset is that the biblical sexual ethic is a fearful repression of sexuality that results in the different moral values. obedience to God's purposes that's driving the Bible. It's a fearful repression of human sexuality. I'm arguing that biblical ethics is the latter. It's a courageous, radical obedience to God's purposes. It is not a repression of human sexuality, I would argue. Now, I'm no expert on Islam, far from it, but just from the bits and pieces of information that I see, like radical Islam could genuinely be accused of what the modern mindset is going to accuse me of. They are afraid of their sexuality. They're driven by their sexuality, but they want to bring it under control, so they have an ethical system that is doing everything it can to deny that they're sexual beings altogether. I think that's probably a relatively accurate charge against radical Islam. It may very well be a legitimate charge that could have been brought against the Pharisees. So there may very well have been within Judaism that tendency. Certainly that was true of most aspects of Phariseeism, is there was what was righteous, and then they were terrified of being unrighteous. So as they put it themselves, they made their traditions way more narrow than ever intended. Why? Because they didn't want to accidentally fall into being unrighteous. So when it came to their sexuality, I dare say it's likely that that was the case with them as well. But there's a universe of difference, I would argue, between the sexual ethics that is actually taught by the Bible and the sexual ethics of a self-righteous, hypocritical value system that's rooted in fear and a repression of sexuality. They're planets apart, worlds apart. They're not the same thing. And what I'm advocating is the very healthy, grounded, in-touch sexual ethic of the Bible, not the fearful, repressive sexual ethic of certain religious systems. And I just important that we make that distinction. So far, so good? For you out there in streaming land, is that true? They can email? No, apparently not. Maybe in the future you'll be able to email questions or comments. Comments, questions so far?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Would you say that the popular Christian culture of today is more on the side of what you are advocating is the biblically grounded sexual ethics, or would you say they're closer to the fearful repression that could be the case for older Judaism or modern Islam?
I really don't know. I feel like I'm so out of touch with modern Christian culture that I don't know what people are saying, what people are teaching, what people are thinking out there. I can't really honestly assess that because I don't think I know. I could guess. What I would guess is they're very confused. I would guess that they are actually have the mindset of the modern secular culture and the rules of some of which are the biblical rules or ethical values and some of which are Christian cultural values. And I would imagine they have this very confusing and incoherent mix of all of that, would be my guess. But I don't really know.
Or maybe another option would be that they, at least some idea of a biblical perspective, but because culture has gone so far that they have been overreacted.
Yeah.
Yeah. People may very well overreact then in a very repressive
context. Yeah. Yeah, that,
because of what's happening in culture.
Yeah, that would make sense too. Okay, an example of Judaism in the time of Jesus there, point D, under 2. Judaism in the time of Jesus and the apostles had gone beyond sexual righteousness. In some respects, perhaps, it was more like the modern Taliban than it was an ideal biblical sexual ethics. I'm partly just guessing there. But a concrete example of that would be in Acts 15:29. Acts 15 was where, early in the church, the Gentiles had started becoming followers of Jesus. Well, Gentiles were Gentiles. They weren't Jews. And so their culture was a Gentile culture. They were not raised in a Jewish culture. So they didn't have the moral scruples that the Jews did. They had very different moral scruples, or little at all. I don't know which. But they certainly didn't have the Jewish value system. So when Gentiles start coming into the church, the question that's batted around and becomes a really hot issue between one faction within the church and the apostles is, well, don't, if you become a disciple of Jesus, don't you have to live like Jews? Don't you have to adopt the value system and the ethics and the morality and the concept of righteousness that the Jews had? Paul, on the one hand, insists, well, no, not in its entirety. But on the other hand, the righteousness, there is an aspect of righteousness that's universal to every Jew, every Gentile. It's endemic to human beings because they're human beings. That, of course, no one had any question about. Of course, you have to be a godly person. You have to be a good person. But you have to be a weirdly religious person according to the weird religious practices of the Jews. And the answer to that was, no, you don't have to do that except, and there was a council in Acts 15 where James and the apostles met, and they hashed that out. And James came up with the position, we don't want to burden Gentiles with living like us, in living in those weird ways that we Jews do, except in these four respects. And he lays out four things that he wants the Gentiles to abide by. Now, in saying that, it's clear from the context that those four things that he's talking about are not moral issues. They're not issues of righteousness. They're not issues of godliness. They're not issues of what it means to be a good person. These are above and beyond what a good person would do. It's joining the Jews in being weird to this extent. But one of the things on that list is fornication. Well, that, to a modern Christian, you look at that and go, wow, why is that going above and beyond the line of duty? Shouldn't every good person not be a fornicator? I mean, doesn't that stand to reason? Well, it does, and that wasn't even at issue. But what's at issue is the Jewish definition of porneia, which is what we translate fornication. What was porneia? And there's two respects in which the Jews would have defined porneia that would have been weird to the Gentiles. One of them is, if a Jew marries a Gentile, he's committing porneia. Now, is that included in James' injunction? I'm not exactly sure. It might be. It might be that what James is saying is, you're asking too much if you're asking us Jews to get over our hesitation to marry outside of our ethnicity. That is so drummed into us and so ingrained in us that don't expect us to be able to do that. We just can't go there. That may not be right, though, because there's another sense in which the Jews had a concept of porneia different than the Gentiles. It's often called degrees of marriage. That is, who's an eligible marriage partner? Can I marry my cousin? Can I marry my second cousin? Can I marry my first cousin? We all know that you can't marry a sibling, but how far out, how unrelated does somebody need to be before they are an eligible marriage partner for me? Well, the Jews had a much larger boundary of restriction than... So what James may be talking about there is, but don't ask us to buy your Gentile degree of separation for marriage. We can't go there. That's just too weird to us Jews. Or maybe both of those things. But notice, in either of those cases, that's not a moral issue. That's an issue of how the Jews interpreted their obligation as what is required of them to be obedient to their God. That's the issue there. It's not an issue of righteousness and godliness. There, on both of those issues, they have a concept of sexual righteousness that goes above and beyond the actual biblical concept of sexual righteousness. It's in keeping with their understanding of the Mosaic Covenant, but it's not really in keeping with what I'm going to call biblical, and I'm going to define biblical here in a moment. On the top of page 2, I've quoted out of some Jewish literature here, "Beware of all whoredom, my son, and chiefly take a wife of the seed of thy fathers, and take not a strange woman to wife, which is not of thy father's tribe. Jacob, remember, my son, that our fathers from the beginning, even that they all married wives of their own kindred, and were blessed in their children, and their seed shall inherit the land." So, I mean, he calls it whoredom, to marry outside of your ethnicity, is a huge act of sexual unrighteousness within that concept of Judaism. Well, Gentiles don't need to accept that. That's a Jewish gig. That's not a matter of actual sexual righteousness. All this is to say we need to make a distinction between religious scruples when it comes to sexuality and truly biblical boundaries when it comes to sexuality. Now, my point B, for the person who has a need to conform culturally, nothing the Bible says could possibly convince him of its sexual ethics, and neither will its values resonate with him. Biblical sexual ethics is so weird, is so out of it by modern standards, that you're not even going to get to first base if you're thinking, I want to be modern. I want to conform to what biblical sexual ethics and modern cultural attitudes are mutually incompatible, completely incompatible. And a perspective on our sexuality that will only resonate with those, I think, few courageous, fiercely independent individuals whose desire is to honor their Creator with their lives and that have no regard for the favor of other people around them. Believing in biblical ethics is going to get you no points in modern culture. I know that. That's not a secret to me. I know that. Okay. What that means is, I think that those who are interested in following biblical sexual ethics today must necessarily form what I would call an underculture, and I'm not a subculture. And let me explain the distinction I make. It's the same social and cultural pressures to affect conformity that any culture uses. That's not what I'm talking about. I don't think we need to form together and form a subculture where we, in one way or another, pressure one another to conform to a certain set of values and so on. That would be a subculture. There's no value in forming a subculture. Many Christians have formed subcultures. The most recent one that I was totally oblivious to it, but what they call it? The man is the boss theology. What is it? There's a technical name for it that they used. Yeah. I'm sorry. I can't remember. But the guy who was the guru, the prophet, has just been found out to have been having an affair with one of his nannies, with his kid's nanny.
The patriarchy movement or complementarianism.
Oh, is that what they call it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I think what they tried to do is form a subculture. Not at all interesting to me. Subcultures are always really are making an existential commitment out of their own individual persuasion to abide by a certain set of values. Otherwise, they just live in the culture that they live in, but they don't buy the values of the culture around them. And specifically, we're talking about sexuality now. So they don't accept the sexual practices, the sexual habits, the sexual mindset, or any of the sexual values of the culture around us. But we don't separate ourselves from the culture in order to do that. We just don't live it. We just don't act like the people around us act. We don't think like the people around us think. We don't value what they value. I mean, that's the advantage of a subculture, is you don't have to be lonely. Being a part of an underculture is a very lonely place to be, or being a disciple of Jesus and following Jesus. Pause there. Question or comments? Yeah?
I was wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the distinction between a subculture and an underculture, because I guess I'm just having a really hard time visualizing what the distinction is, at least how such a meaningful distinction could be maintained. Since people naturally tend to gravitate towards other like-minded people and associate with them, it seems that an underculture would almost inevitably become a subculture, assuming that they have, you know, other clips.
Not whether or not you congregate or whether or not you have friendships. I mean, because as you say, that's just human, is that we like-minded people, we enjoy being around them, we enjoy socializing them. So I would expect in an underculture we would gravitate toward people who share our values and so on. I'm not denying that. The difference is, what do you institutionalize? Subcultures will create institutions, publishing houses, churches, organizations with all the bylaws and rules and all that kind of stuff, and will have enforcement mechanisms. They'll basically have various ways of promoting conformity and even coercing people, just like culture itself does. And I have no interest in that. That doesn't there's nothing about our faith and promoting conformity for its own sake. It's just not what our faith is about. So that's the difference. To visualize it, and we're all probably going to create a different picture of this, but I try to visualize, what was it like when Jesus went to a party with tax gatherers and sinners? Jesus was part of an underculture when he did that. He didn't share their values. He didn't share their antagonism toward God and the things of God. He was marching to the beat of a completely different drum from all of them. But it didn't stop him from socializing with them. So that's what I'm talking about. That's what it would be like to be a part of an underculture. Anything else? Second point here. With regard to moral judgment about sexual behavior, or any other behavior for that matter, the Jesus follower is interested in what the Bible teaches. The Jesus believer conforms his beliefs to what he is convinced by sound reason is true, not by what appears to him to be true. He's convinced by what he knows to be true. Granted, he's granting authority to the Scripture. So one very important way in which he knows something is true is he has studied the Bible, interpreted the Bible, has become convinced that the Bible teaches it, and that becomes solid ground for him. But he knows it, that it's true, and he'd rather act on what he knows to be true. There's a famous statement in "And Not by Sight." Good. I buy a lot of Christians, because I think a lot of Christians take that to mean we walk by loyalty to what somebody tells us is the truth, rather than what our mind tells us is true. That's how it, something like that is how it often gets put, faith over reason. So we should put our belief in the Bible over what sound reasoning tells us is true. That couldn't be further from what Paul means by that. What Paul means by that faith is putting your trust in sound reasoning. That is, first of all, I wouldn't translate it faith, because that just totally misleads us. What he's saying is we walk by what we believe is true, not by sight, that is, not by what appears to be true to us. We walk by what we know and believe to be true, and not what it looks like. What he's dealing with is the phenomenon that all of us look at life and experience life through some kind of lenses that have been put in place by our culture, by our experience, by our background, but a big, huge factor is by our culture. The culture around us has given us our cues. Look at the world this way. Think about it this way. Value these things. Don't value those things. And we just wear those like clothing, or literally put them on like glasses. And then we look out at the world, looking at the world through those lenses. Well, that's how the world appears to me. It's very familiar to me. It's very comfortable to me. It's very plausible to me. I mean, that just, my own eyes, that's just reality. Well, all of us who are committed to following Jesus recognize my eyes deceive me. They've been lying to me my whole cotton picking life. If I just look at life the way I look at life, I come to all kinds of wrong conclusions. What I need, what I desperately need, is to be retrained in the way I think about life and what I value in life. And the Bible is that which it has been given to me to retrain me. So, a combination of rational thinking about my life and experience, guided by the authoritative text of the Scripture, and allow that to guide me and tutor me in my thinking, I come to believe certain things are true. Me? Because what looks true to me is what I'm familiar with, is what I'm accustomed to. Yeah, I mean, I think a ton of examples. Let's think about sexuality in the context of sexuality. When I was growing up, it was commonplace in churches to do what I call to engage in boyfriending and girlfriending, which seems so innocent by modern standards. But they would couple up and would have a quasi-marital kind of relationship for however long it lasted. You know, as long as that girl is my girlfriend, or as long as that guy is my boyfriend, we are committed to each other, we are faithful to each other, and he's up to a point sexually, because we are, after all, a couple. So we will be, to some extent, sexually intimate with each other. Now, the church put boundaries on that. You didn't actually have sexual intercourse, but you nonetheless engaged in certain sexual activities together, because that's what boyfriends and girlfriends do. Well, I don't exactly know where this came from, but I somehow, intuitively, as I had gleaned what I had gleaned about biblical Christianity from my environment, from my upbringing, disconnect between what I think the Bible would say about how we should interact sexually and what was being practiced all around me by everybody that I knew, that they weren't compatible with each other. So the question that I had to face was, do I go with what I believe and know is true? Or do I simply accept the practice, the values, the attitude, and the mindset of every other Christian I know? And it didn't make sense to me to conform to what everybody else was doing, because it didn't ring true to me. It didn't seem like that's actually what the Bible was saying. A more current example would be attitudes toward homosexuality among Christians today. I think there's a whole generation of people coming along who have conformed to the attitudes, have been acculturated, who it just makes sense to them that whoever you want to, I mean, isn't that the end of it? I mean, what else is there to say? What else should you even think about? I mean, isn't that just how it is? And that just looks so true to them, given the lenses that they've been given to look at reality through. But what if the Bible teaches us something different than that? Then what we are being encouraged to do, to conform my thinking and to adopt the attitudes that are in conformity with what I know is true, not with what seems true to me because I'm a product of my culture. Does that help? Mm-hmm. So is that clear? So, sexual ethics, my desire, my hope would be that we will make that important decision then to live our lives and behave and promote in the lives of other people by persuading them to live in the light of what the Bible actually teaches, not what just looks reasonable to me or looks plausible to me as I look at the world around me. Another thing I've been thinking about recently is, maybe this is because I've studied philosophy, that this just seems so automatic to me that it doesn't seem worth saying, but it's dawned on me that maybe this is worth saying. Coming to believe or coming to know something, and coming to know something from the Bible, is, I suspect, a little bit like rock climbing. Like, I wouldn't know anything about rock climbing, but what I would imagine rock climbing must be like. Imagine a rock climber making his way up to a ledge on a sheer cliff, and then looking to the next ledge that he needs to get to, and jumping down to the ground, and then trying to figure out now how to. You don't get to the next ledge by not trusting the foothold that you've already got. You want to make your way from the foothold you've got up to the next foothold. Use what you've already gained to make progress further. And I think what I see happening oftentimes when it comes to complex argumentation or complex reasoning is people will get the first foothold, and then when you ask them to go further, they want to jump back down to the ground because that's safe. That's what they're comfortable with. That's what they're familiar with. That's where they've always stood. So I want to stand where I've always stood. I don't want you taking me any further, not from here. I don't know if I trust here enough to go any further. And why don't they trust here? The temptation that we all face is that we want to walk by sight and not by faith. That is, I want to proceed and live in the comfortable, safe space of where I've always lived. Don't make me use my head to decide something else is true. And even if you can get me to concede that something else is true, don't make me live as if that's true or think from there to proceed in my thinking any further from there. Because that's scary, and I don't like scary. I want to go back to the safety of what I've always believed and what's familiar to me. So part of what I'm going to ask you to do in these notes is to think with me. I mean, be a rock climber. We'll inch our way toward an understanding of biblical sexual ethics. We'll make some ground, but we're not going to get any further unless you accept the ground that we've gained as ground that we've gained. What we've been persuaded is true is actually true. And I'm going to act like it's true, and I'm going to think like it's true, and I'm going to proceed further on the basis of my conviction. That's true. I hope that makes some sense. Okay? Now, I don't, not in this class, authority of the Bible, I'm just going to assume it. I'm willing to argue for the authority of the Bible, but that's a whole other class. The Jesus believer grants authority to the Bible above any other authority. The Bible is his primary source of instruction with regard to matters of morality, theology, philosophy, and spirituality. So a Jesus follower will not be impressed by what is or is not acceptable to his culture. He's only interested in what the Bible actually teaches. Now, at least grant me this. That's where I'm coming from, and that's my assumption. I mean, you may not be persuaded of that, but at least recognize that that's the basis upon which I'm coming to my conclusions. Okay, so what do I mean then? Point three, what's the teaching of the Bible with regard to sexual ethics? To understand what the Bible teaches on sexual ethics, a person has to understand the entire biblical worldview and then the ramifications of that worldview for sexual ethics. I will not know what the Bible teaches simply by discovering what I take to be some kind of decisive verse. That's not the right way to read the Bible with respect to any issue or any topic or any point of theology or doctrine or philosophy. You can only know what the Bible teaches by understanding the entire coherent worldview of the Bible. And then and only then are you in a position to understand its implications for specific ethical questions. So to make moral judgments consistent with what the Bible teaches, my moral judgments with regard to sexual behavior must be made on the basis of the theory of human sexuality that is taught in or assumed by what the Bible asserts. So what we have to do if we're going to construct its understanding, its theory of human sexuality. So I'm not going to take you to a verse and say something 3:17 says this, so there. It doesn't work that way. 3:17 says that, but what does that mean? And how do I know that that's what that means? And what's the context there? And what's the context within the context of the entire worldview of the Bible? Only then do I know what something 3:17 means. Only then. And even then, if I try to extrapolate that and divorce that from everything else that the Bible says, I may distort its implications. So I have to, ultimately, as a follower of Jesus, I'm a lifelong student of the Bible. And as a lifelong student of the Bible, I'm going to be constantly learning, constantly adjusting it in order to worldview and its perspective. Well, when it comes to sexual ethics, I'm going to take my understanding of the biblical worldview and its theory of sexuality and draw conclusions from that. And it's only as good as my grasp of the worldview is of the Bible. But that's what I think we all need to do in the long run. Yeah?
So in a lot of modern scholarship, you have accusations that, speaking of the biblical worldview, is not really accurate because there are so many different times and places and cultures encompassed in the Bible.
Yeah.
Could you briefly respond to that?
Well, just that I don't buy that. I mean, that would be part of that course on biblical authority and the role of the Bible and the role that it plays. And that's a huge question. It's an important question. It's a vital question. And I would love to talk about it, but for the sake of this class, I don't want to get sidetracked there. So I think the Bible speaks with one coherent picture of reality. That's the uncanny, remarkable thing about the Bible. That's what it means, in part, for it to be inspired, I think, is that all of these people from diverse times in history, different languages, different times in history, are all somehow taught by the same teacher, the Spirit of God, who has imparted to them part of, at least, the same worldview. And they're speaking out of their comprehension of that one single coherent worldview. And that's what I'm trying to derive when I study the Bible. That's my perspective. So, point A there under 2. The Bible teaches more on sexuality than what can be found in the explicit assertions of individual verses. What you find today on any controversy in sexual ethics, what you'll find is everybody is still playing by the old rules. I got a verse, and I'll quote my verse at you, and that's supposed to convince you that I'm right. Somebody else will come up with another verse. Well, I've got this verse. What do you do about that? Oh, yeah, well, I've got this other verse. What do you do about that? Yeah, and I've got this verse. What do you do about that? And we just do this duel with verses back and forth. Totally unproductive, totally beside the point. It misses the whole point. The issue is, what is the Bible teaching us? How more than verses? We need to grasp the worldview of the Bible and understand the implications of that worldview. A single verse here and there might give us guidance. It might help us by showing how an apostle or a prophet thinks of the implications of that worldview. So that's not nothing. I mean, that's important, but it's not the whole story. So my view of biblical sexual ethics is going to rely upon statements that the Bible makes that no one would ever dream to use as a proof text in a battle over some controversy in sexual ethics. Things like in the beginning, and his relationship to reality that has very important implications for how we think about everything, including, I know what the Bible teaches more on sexuality than what can be found in the explicit assertions of individual verses. No, I guess not. Okay, so 3 points under that. I cannot find a verse that teaches that adult child sex is a sin. I'm not going to find a verse that says that. But there's no doubt in my mind that from a biblical perspective, understanding human sexuality the way the Bible understands it, that of course it would be considered evil from the perspective of the Bible, even though I can't find a verse that says so. There's no verse that tells me it's perverse to have an erotic attachment to my automobile, but that doesn't mean that the Bible would consider it morally acceptable to have an erotic attachment to your automobile. You think I'm being facetious? I watched a whole documentary on a British documentary on Americans who have an erotic attachment to their automobile. Well, from a biblical perspective, that's perverse. That is utterly and completely perverse. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a proof text that's going to tell you that that's a sin, right?
Cars back
then. Yep. It wasn't it, either.
It's wrong to have an erotic attachment to your back animals.
Yeah, that one is addressed in the Bible. If it were the case that no verse tells me that it is wrong for marriage to occur between two human beings of the same sex, so let's say, just for the sake of argument, let's say that I can't find a verse that tells me that that's immoral. Would the fact that I can't find a verse tell that the Bible would consider same-sex marriage morally unobjectionable? And what I'm saying is the answer to that is no. It wouldn't follow. I need to decide that question based on the theory of sexuality that the Bible teaches, not on the basis of some verse. What the Bible asserts in individual verses must be understood in the light of the Bible's theory of marriage and sexuality and in the light of its entire worldview. Take the statement, love your neighbor. Years ago, I went to the grocery store. When I came out of the grocery store, I was handed a tract. When I took the tract home, the tract was all about young women who are disciples really offerings. And the proof text for that was, the Bible tells us to love our neighbor, right? Moses, David, pervert, as you might imagine, given that. And it was a world back in the 70s. Well, when I interpret something and put it in whatever context I want to, make it mean something in what the biblical author meant. And would there be some sort of limits on what it means to love your neighbor? Yeah. And those limits are going to be known. I need the worldview to inform me, restrict me, confine me, teach me how I'm supposed to think about everything else that the Bible says in every place that it says it. To construe, as much of Christian culture has over the past half a century, to construe the handful of relevant verses that Jesus teaches as suggesting that that's not what Jesus meant or explicitly said that, it doesn't make any sense. but it was something else. And we, in order to know exactly what Jesus intended and what he meant, we have to take into account everything that he taught and everything that he believed. And what did Jesus believe? He believed what the worldview, I would argue, that the Bible teaches us. So I have to study the whole book now in judgment about what any part of the Bible means. They are seeking to defend on the grounds that to deny the legal possibility of marriage to gay people is to violate the Bible's supreme ethical principle. But that argument of the biblical worldview, it disregards all kinds of things. This argument assumes that relationship is the as well as in sexuality. The fact that truth, moral purity, one's relationship to God, by relationship I mean relationship to, with other human beings, that that's the supreme principle in all of life and sexuality. But that ignores that truth, moral purity, one's relationship to God, and hence sexual purity, never be allowed to take precedence over authentic loving relationship. That's what it assumes. Loving relationship is so important that truth be damned, my relationship with God be damned, sexual purity be damned. That, those don't matter. What really matters is that we be kind and compassionate and respectful, and that we love our neighbor, that we love other people. That's not the biblical perspective. In the biblical worldview, there are other things that are also important. Truth is important. My relationship to God is important. I mean, go back for a second. Think about the very, very first transgression in the Bible. Eat of the fruit of this tree. Who did it hurt? Who did it hurt? If anything, it hurt Eve to have the restriction, right? I mean, what if she wanted to eat of the fruit of that tree? Why shouldn't she have been able to eat of the fruit of that tree? There's absolutely no reason for her not to eat of the fruit of that tree except God said no. It was a test of her relationship with God, pure and simple. There was no other reason for her not to do it. What's your relationship with to me like? Am I the creator? Are you the creature? As a creature, are you obligated to me, the creator, in any way? Should you respect? A lot of question of whether anybody gets hurt. It's a question of what kind of person are you in relationship to God, in relationship to your creator. And much of righteousness is simply a matter of acting, behaving, pulls out of a mindset that says, I'm a creature made by a creator, and my life is here to honor my creator. That's why I act. That's the way I think. All of that gets ignored to the height of that you love people. Because there are a lot where you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's not going to help you with that. Okay?
It's just going to observe the same discussion is not uncommonly expressed, the idea that rooted in creation is the idea that, you know, it's not good for man to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that is taken as a stand-in from there. What's extrapolated is, so it's the relationship that matters. It is not a relationship between a man and a woman. The principle is, it's not so any relationship is better than not having a relationship.
Okay. Yeah. And again, you see the mistake. That's abstracting that principle out, completely taking it apart from the biblical worldview taken as a whole. And everything that the Bible says, and everything that's valuable, and everything that's true from a biblical perspective. Okay? I mean, why did Jesus live his life single? Why did Paul live his life single, if in fact that's the supreme principle? You know, because they had other priorities. Other things were important to them. Things were important to them, so much more important that they were willing to suffer what they were obligated to do. Does love for my neighbor require? That would just be silly. I mean, clearly that's not what loving your neighbor means, but we argue as if that's, at times, some people argue as if that's what it means. That, well, to love your neighbor means I need to let him have what he wants, get what he wants. That the above argument begs the question, and begs the question, by the way, I'm a philosopher, begs the question means you assume the answer in your premises. That's what begs the question to me. It assumes the very point at issue. It assumes that there is nothing morally objectionable about homosexuality as such. Well, if you assume that, then probably it makes sense that if there's nothing morally objectionable about it from the get-go, then yeah, why why would there be anything? But that's the very point at issue. That's the very point that needs to be argued. To love my neighbor is to promote my neighbor's well-being. Don't I have to know what is truly good for my neighbor in order to love him? I think so. Isn't the entire scope of the Bible's teaching relevant to answering the question of what is just it? I need to inculcate it. I need to know. Now, for the rest of these notes, in some ways, this is the meat of what I want to say. I'm not going to construct the biblical theory of sexuality here. That's part two. And that's an important part of what I want to say as well. But since here I'm contrasting the biblical perspective with the modern mindset, much of the meat here's with the mindset. No wonder we come up with different conclusions. No wonder we have a different ethics, because we're worlds apart in the way that we look at reality. So I have a series of points of disagreement between the Bible and modern culture. The first one is this. God created a purposeful, telic creation. Everything has a telos, a purpose, and it has a design. Very foreign to the modern mindset. And I don't know if I could give an adequate historical analysis of why and where the modern mindset comes from in this regard. But it used to be commonplace throughout most of Western history and Western civilization to think about creation and about reality, to ask, what's the purpose for this, and what's the purpose for that, and what's the purpose for the other thing, and to assume that there's a creator God who gave everything in the created order its purpose and its place and its role and its function, and designed it to be fitting to that function. That used to be commonplace. In the modern world, we have come to think that the reality I live is a kind of blank slate. I'm just this biological organism, and there may be some givens. There may be some biology and chemistry and physics that's a given, but what I do with it is kind of like up to me. I to invest my human sexuality. There's no right or wrong. It's just a matter of what I decide to do with it. I dare say that's the prevailing attitude in our culture. So those two perspectives are worlds apart. I'm answerable to the objective truth about the way things are. Human sexuality is what the Creator purposed it to be and intended for it be, and it ain't nothing else. It is what God made it to be. So the question is, it's going to be helpful to me. It's going to give me some insight into what God had in mind. So my ethics, behavior, and my values, and my attitudes, and my perspectives can conform to the true objective truth about human sexuality constitutes an objective reality to which human beings are accountable. Human sexuality is not something I can make into whatever I want it to be. It is what it is. That is, it is what God designed and purposed it to be. It is not mine to do with what I please. The biblical worldview is completely compatible with the notion that natural laws exist. If, by the concept of natural law, I mean I understand it in the concepts of natural law, that's different than the biblical worldview. But if by natural law we mean what the Bible, we should work with. Okay, and what's the right way to think about it? The right purpose. What is God's design? What is the function God had in mind for the various things that He created? To speak of something as being against nature, as Paul does in Romans chapter 1. To speak of something as being against nature means to speak of something as being at odds with God's purpose and design. As being against nature means that sexual behavior is at odds with God's purpose and design. So I won't take the time to read it now, but if you look at Romans 1, 26 through 2:2, he makes several statements along those lines about homosexuality. He just takes it for granted. He calls it against nature. Men exchange the function that was purposed for their sexuality for something else. Women exchange sexuality for human beings. Do that? Yeah? They sure to do that? Not from a biblical perspective. because as a creature before my Creator, I am obligated to honor and respect the teleological nature of God's creation, to live in conformity with that, in harmony with that, in sync with that, with His purposes and His design. Consider what might be sexuality. We must ask what is natural with regard to human sexuality. In the debate, I mean, it almost gets humorous. Well, homosexuality is not natural. And somebody else will say, uh-huh, there's some monkeys that do it. Or, you know, I heard about biology to be homosexual activity by certain kinds of species of animals. That's not what Paul means. Paul doesn't mean do like the monkeys and the snails. What Paul means is, and that's why it's critical that we understand what he means is God created human beings, and He created human beings to be sexual beings of sexual beings, and He designed human beings, male and female, for we need to live our lives as sexual beings in conformity and in harmony with what God had in mind for human beings to be male and female. Never mind what animals do. That's totally irrelevant to what a human being should do. Just because it has the word nature in it doesn't mean we're talking about National Geographic or what we mean by nature. What we mean by nature is the way, the function that God created for the various aspects of His creation. And what we're interested in is human sexuality. And one of the huge, big differences between human sexuality is not for mating. An important aspect of human sexuality, but it's not the essential aspect. It's not the most important aspect. It's not the thing that plays the most important role. It does for animals, but it doesn't for human beings, because human sexuality is qualitatively different, an entirely different beast, an entirely different thing.
I mean, I think they're making the carrier argument. They're making that argument by animals because we learn about God through nature. So if it's natural within nature, then you would be arguing that what would be wrong with human sexuality if God made animals that naturally engage in homosexuality?
No one's going to make the argument that some animals eat their own species, so what's wrong with human beings eating their own species? I hope no one, right? Okay. That, yes, we do learn things about God from nature. The question is, what do we learn? And it's just too facile to say, I can learn what I should do sexually by watching what the animals do sexually. That starts with the assumption that human sexuality is not at all distinctive from animal sexuality. And I doesn't teach me that.
But nature does teach you that the norm of monkeys is to have sexualities for reproduction, and yet monkeys may mate homosexually. So, but the animals that eat themselves, that may be the norm for that particular animal. So I guess I'm saying nature teaches you that some things fall out of the norm.
Okay, so some things fall out of the norm. The norm is for human beings to marry, but some things fall out of the norm. Jesus didn't marry, Paul didn't marry.
Okay, so you're just basically saying that I'm taking the tack that nature teaches us something about God, puts a lens on God, and you're just basically saying we can't look at animals and get any cues and apply.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay. Right, I am saying that, and what I'm saying is nature itself teaches me that. If I want to know what nature teaches about human sexuality, I shouldn't look out there, I should look in here. What truer test? I'm a product of my culture, so the problem with that is I need an objective outside voice in my introspection to help guide me and keep me from just being blinded by my own prejudices that I have inherited from my culture. But if I want to talk about what does nature teach me about human sexuality, I should ask myself, what makes sense to me should engage sexually with one another, not by looking at animals. See the same pattern between species. I mean, some animals don't have sex. How many modern people are going to take their cues from that we should be asexual because the animals are asexual? That doesn't make any sense.
Could you say that nature itself has fallen, and so therefore if you see homosexuality where it shouldn't be in nature, that you could just point to that and say that's just...
Well, I wouldn't go there because I don't believe in that kind of fall. I think nature today is the same nature that existed before Adam and Eve transgressed. This is the world God made it. There was a duck-billed platypus before the fall.
Okay, well, it didn't have to fall. It's still, nature is obviously imperfect. It's in a fallen state, even though there was no date of the fall. It's in a fallen state. So can we just say that that stuff happening out there is against God? It's in...
Yeah, I see. I don't think so. I think homosexual activity in animals. They're animals. Yeah, we can take this up further.
Jack,
so,
one question from the
sure.
Letter.
Okay. Sure.
Mike is asking if the only real question is, "Will you obey God?" How can Christianity be distinguished from any other religion?
So, if the only question is,
"Will you obey God?"
That's a big, huge question that I can't give a full answer to. My assumption is that we are followers of Jesus. And my assumption is that a follower of Jesus will imitate Jesus. I will be teaching on that subject in another month at Reformation Fellowship, and that stuff should be available. But I believe in the inerrancy of the Bible because I think Jesus believed in the inerrancy of the Scriptures. And there's a whole argument needs to be made about that. But that's where I find out, that's where I discover what God requires of me and what God wants from me. So I make no apologies about the fact that I'm a radical biblicist. I believe that what the Bible teaches is the truth revealed from God, and that I have no other authority besides even Christianity. Serves as an authority over and above the Bible. I will take the Bible over Christianity any day. So the question then becomes, so important question then. And how do I determine that? I'm not skeptical about the possibility of that. I know it's difficult. I've devoted my life to pursuing that question. I know it's difficult. I know you don't get there easily, but I know it's possible. And I know I haven't arrived yet, but I'm working on it. Okay, let me just finish up point A. Given that this is the biblical worldview, it makes no sense whatsoever to reject the understood to mean whatever coherence to the created order would dictate. That natural law gives us important information about how we human beings ought to behave. The fact that homosexuality is an important datum in reaching a rational conclusion about the morality of homosexual behavior, because it gives us important information about God's purpose and design for human sexuality. But it's not a decisive argument. It's an important piece of information, but in and of itself it's not decisive, because the question is, what's the role of human sexuality in God's design? And my argument will be, it's not primarily procreation, therefore that kind of undercuts that argument to a certain extent. But would there be some compatibility with God's purpose for genuine purpose for sexuality, human sexuality, and the fact that it's through heterosexual sexuality and nurtured by a male and female and so on and so forth? Is that part of God's design? Seems to be the case. It makes sense in all kinds of ways. So what does nature teach us? What is the nature of maleness and femaleness, the nature of mothers and fathers, the nature of the needs of children, the psychic needs of children, and so on? You put all that together, and what does that teach us? Probably, I think, that God's intention from the very beginning was to have males and females needed to create a child and bring a child in, and a father who have input into their life and are nurturing the child, etc., etc. That just seems what nature itself actually teaches. Is that because in the beginning it says God created the heavens and the earth. And if we believe that God is a rational God who created a rational creation that has a teleological structure to it, then I would expect to see everything working design that makes sense that is coherent. And that, of course, is what I think I see with the biblical ethic that sees male and female marrying and having children and raising their children together. Okay, we'll take up point B next week, same time, same station. Any final questions or comments? Okay, thank you.